Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
We Californians are now deciding the future of our state's water supply infrastructure, and also the fate of many Sacramento River species of plants and animals. My guest today has created a visual documentation of the Sacramento River through the eyes of an artist. Jeff Fricker has a master's in fine arts degree in photography from the San Francisco Art Institute. His photographs are housed in permanent collections across the United States, including the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, the Oakland Museum of California, the Crocker Art Gallery, the Library of Congress, and other cultural institutions in California, Hawaii, Arizona, Nevada, and Texas. He has received awards and grants to document watersheds, including one from the National Endowment for the Arts and a grant for exploratory research from the National Science Foundation. He has now published a collection of his photographs of the Sacramento River called Sacrament, Homage to a River. Jeff Fricker, welcome.
Oh, thank you.
I'm always curious as to the influences on artist work, and you had a lot of them. There was a confluence of influences in your life, but I would like to go back in your family to somebody that really I don't think you knew had any influence on your work, but it's your great-grandfather.
Yes. My great-grandfather was a bookstore owner in Abergavenny, Wales.
In Wales now.
Right.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Charles Fricker, your great-grandfather.
Right.
Was in Wales.
In Wales. And he had a bookstore, and he was quite a photographer. We went to visit, you know, the home where they lived, and it was just really kind of exciting. I actually went with the intention of re-photographing some of the photographs that he had taken. And in the process of doing that, we went to a museum because we thought maybe they might help us find some of the locations that we were looking for. And immediately they recognized the name Charles Fricker because they had quite a bit of his work in their collection. And they helped us a lot in terms of finding those locations.
So you've been photographing water as your work, and your great-grandfather photographed water.
He did. There was the River Usk and the River Wye that go through Abergavenny, and he photographed those rivers quite a bit, and then also the canals that were taken off the river to put coal on barges on those canals that came off the river to Cardiff.
Now, how much did you know about your great-grandfather before you went? And you went back with your wife, right?
Mm-hmm.
You went to Wales back.
Right.
You went to Wales. And how much did you know about your great-grandfather before you made this trip?
Not a lot, except that my father did find his journal that he eventually, of course, came to California. That's why I'm here. and he wrote his journal as he was coming up over the Sierras. And that was a really beautiful piece of writing. And it struck me at that point that I wanted to know more about him.
Yeah. Don't we wish all our ancestors had kept journals?
Yes.
So this great-grandfather, Charles Fricker, moves to California. He immigrates to California.
Right.
And not of this northern part, though.
No. They went down to Hemet, California, one of the largest dams in California at the time. It was the second largest dam in 1896, something close to that time. Where he purchased land for a citrus grove. There was really nothing there when they moved. So it was in the desert, and Hemet Dam they also bought water with the land so they could have a farm.
So then your father, you're on your mother's side too. There were artists there. But your father, you have the same name as your father.
Right.
And what did he do?
Well, he grew up in Hemet. I was born in Hemet. He met my mother in Hemet, and the Brubaker family, that's my mother's side, basically they all met. And it's because of that dam that they met. I guess the reason I'm in that gene pool is because that dam went up. Because everybody, it was three people, Whittier, that's a name most people recognize. I can't think of the other two, but another gentleman from England, and they all basically promoted this water and this land, kind of like people would promote condominiums in Hawaii, something like that. And so they found out about this area, and they basically started their new life in Southern California.
But then your father and mother didn't stay in Southern California.
No. My father went on and got his medical degree and eventually moved up into the area near Sacramento, Fair Oaks. And they moved up onto the bluffs there and got some horses, just like my dad had when he was a kid. And we lived in the suburbs of Sacramento back in those days in the early 50s. That was before Folsom Dam came in when we first moved there.
So when you say you grew up on the bluffs.
Right, overlooking the river.
Overlooking the?
American River.
American River.
Not the Sacramento River, yeah. Right.
But there you grew up on a river. So here's another river in your family's life.
Right.
And now your mother was an artist.
She was. And oddly enough, she really loved water. mostly salt water, but all of her paintings, almost all of them, had something to do with seascapes.
So you had your great-grandfather was a photographer, your father a photographer, mm-hmm. and your grandfather, your mother's father, was also a photographer.
A farmer and a photographer, but he typically photographed things around the farm.
Mm-hmm. and then thanks to his being able to do things around the farm, if you're a farmer, you fix things yourself.
Correct.
And this information mm-hmm. that he had mm-hmm. allowed you, now this was later now, in the 1980s, you actually built a camera.
I built it out of styrofoam, and I was living in Japan at the time. And after having put it together with styrofoam, I took it to a Japanese camera maker. And it was terrific. It was I loved that little camera. It's not exactly small. It was for sheet film that's 8 by 10 inches, but mm-hmm. but it was somewhat small for that type of camera.
My guest is Jeff Fricker. And he has put a collection together of his photographs of the Sacramento River. The title of the book is Sacrament, Homage to a River. Now, you did the photographs, and then you had text in here. Rebecca Lawton prepared the text
yes.
that goes along with the photographs. Well, you also, speaking of being able to build a camera, you did some of the photographs, did you take with a camera that you built?
Oh, yeah. Almost all of the pictures were taken with the camera that I built. Or, you know, it was built for me by this Japanese.
That you designed.
That I designed.
And was built.
Right.
And so you still have that camera.
Yes.
And you're still taking photographs with it.
Actually, I've kind of gone to the dark side, if you will.
Oh.
Become a digital photographer.
Oh. Yeah, because you say your dad now takes digital photographs.
Uh-huh.
And your dad is 93? Is he 94 yet?
You know, he just passed away in November.
Oh,
but he was photographing up to the last day, really. He was photographing all the time.
So now you're taking digital photographs. But mm-hmm. now, a lot of these pictures have an unusual angle. You feel like, well, am I up in a helicopter? Am I a bird? How did you manage that?
I really was very impressed with the 19th century photographers that usually photograph from an elevated perspective. And so I thought I would like to be able to do that wherever I was. And so I purchased a hydraulic lift and mounted it on my pickup truck. And that gave me the ability to kind of get a bird's eye perspective to help to sort of contextualize the mm-hmm. space.
So you get the viewer gets a broader view of what the scene is.
Right.
Well, you mentioned that your father was a radiologist. I don't know if you mentioned that he was a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
He was a radiologist.
Uh-huh.
He was a photographer practicing in the Sacramento area. And he actually had a solo exhibit in the 1970s as a photographer.
He did. And that was, to me, one of the most surprising events. He's very modest, and he always kind of encouraged us not to be too pumped up about ourselves. And so he had these photographs that he had taken on a trip to India. He took the whole family to India, where he worked as a physician for a period of time, and we were there. And during that time, every spare moment, he photographed the native Indians in India, and then their work in their farms and just their daily lives. And then 2 or 3 years later, he had a body of work that he took to the Museum of Modern Art, and they had a one-man show right after Wynn Bullock, another really well-known photographer. I didn't know it at the time because he didn't really like to post, but I think some of his physician friends knew. But I was going to the Art Institute at the time, and some of my friends came to me and said, oh, gee, that's beautiful work you did, because my name is exactly the same name. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I should have rode that wave for a while.
Sure, thank you very much.
Thanks, Mike. But I confessed that it, and I didn't realize it. It was funny because I didn't realize he had a show there. And so, well, thanks, you know. And so I went down and saw that he actually had an installation there of his work.
My guest is Jeff Fricker Jr., as opposed to your father we were just talking about. And he's put together a collection of his photographs, Sacrament, Homage to a River. And you mentioned that you were at the San Francisco Art Institute in the MFA program. And that's when you, was it then that you began to see the camera as more than just, say, a interesting pastime?
Absolutely. There was one person that I just totally gravitated to, John Collier Jr., who was trained as a cultural anthropologist, but he was a photographer, and he wrote a book called Cultural Anthropology, Photography as a Tool. And he used that book to teach a cultural anthropology class at San Francisco State. So he would kind of teach there in photography as in a documentary kind of way. But he'd come over and talk at the Art Institute and speak there and instructed there as well. But I just hung on every word. He could talk about a photograph for long, long periods of time. And I all of a sudden realized there's so much in a photograph that I was not really aware of.
So he was a major influence in your work.
Huge influence, yeah.
Well, now, there was also a book by John Fowles and called The Tree. And how was that influential?
It kind of dovetailed in with what John Collier taught. In that book, Fowles talks about tools and how they addict you to purpose. And I realized I love tools, actually.
So tools addict you to purpose.
Yes.
And what do you mean by that?
And, well, typically a tool has a purpose. And so usually you're doing something with a tool. And with a camera, you're making a photograph. And basically he made an argument specifically about the camera. And it was kind of upsetting to me because I had sort of invested my career with this camera, and I loved nature. And he essentially said that if you really want to appreciate nature in its fullest way, that you really needed to smell the rose rather than photograph it, if you will. And because oftentimes you forget, you're so intent on documenting it and getting it just right that you forget to experience it. Mm-hmm. And it troubled me because I was like, this is what I like to photograph is the natural world, because I had grown up on the American River and that was kind of my influence there. I think in the book, Rebecca says to fall in love with the wild river is to be changed forever. And I didn't realize it at the time, but I think growing up on the American had really connected me to nature in a way that I didn't realize. And so I saw this problem of tools and connecting with nature. So I decided that if I was going to use a camera, I would photograph nature, but maybe more with regard to our footprint in nature.
Well, I've seen guidebooks to backpackers or pilgrims saying, don't even take a camera with you because you'll miss the experience of being there if you're always focused on seeing it through a camera lens.
Yeah, and if you read John Fowles' argument, it's pretty flawless. I mean, it's pretty, I think he's right.
Convinced you.
He did, yeah.
My guest is Jeff Fricker, and he has put together a collection of his photographs, Sacrament, Homage to a River. And the title of your book, Sacrament, now this is what Rebecca, in her text, explains that, but what's your explanation of the choice of the title?
Oh, you know, I just thought it was, I guess it was the day that Moraga, they baptized the river.
And Moraga was
a Spanish explorer in 1808, I believe. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I guess that was the name that they gave the river at that point. Yeah, I like the term itself because it is it's a very spiritual thing as well, and so it kind of connects to religion when you think about it, sacrament.
Mm-hmm. She mentions, Rebecca does, El Rio del Sacramento, and because it was a special day that he discovered this river. We hesitate to say discovered the river because the river was there,
right?
But he encountered it. He came upon this river.
Yes. Yeah.
So we have this long history of the Sacramento River, and you mentioned that you love nature, and you decided you wanted to photograph. I don't know if even if that would choose. I would say that you probably there wasn't a point where you decided to photograph the river, but it was just so much a part of you.
Yeah, you know, it was interesting. It was after John Collier, and then I realized a lot of the photographs that I was taking were just isolated images of nature, but then I started to really find that the most interesting photographs that I, for myself anyway, were photographs that had some human element where water was kind of a reflection of culture in our relationship to, so it was water as a cultural reflection in a sense. And so that's one of the things that it struck me, I think everybody realizes it, that most civilizations start up around water sources like rivers.
The Nile, the Tigris, Euphrates.
Right. You know. And so it struck me that the histories and the layers of information that are there are, I'm kind of really excited about history and things that have happened in the past.
Because I think you can't help mm-hmm. but be when you see this river. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I do, or just look at the creek. I go sit by the creek that feeds into the Sacramento River. And I just wonder how far back this history goes. Am I sitting where Native Americans fished or walked?
Right. And in even going back further, like Rebecca does in the book, it's like geologically, I mm-hmm. mean, you know, this used to be a ocean floor where we're sitting right now. And so it's just, you know, change is something that surrounds us. And I think photographs are a great way to sort of photograph a space and look at maybe something that's where there might be a grinding hole of, you know, mortars where the Native Americans were, or maybe just a flume or something like that. You know, something happened there. And you might not know exactly, but there's what's interesting, too, is that the photograph kind of arrests your eye, so you can kind of contemplate what might have happened there. That's why I like still photography so much, because you can sort of just look at it and kind of think about it, contemplate it.
Well, people might expect, since they can't see these pictures we're talking about, they might expect them to be in color.
Yes.
Why did you choose to use black and white? Only.
Yeah. I think the primary reason is probably, well, that's a good question. I was very much influenced by a lot of the early photographers, by Weston and Ansel Adams, people like that. But it was really more of an economic thing. I was using large format film, and the cost of color film for large negatives was just so prohibitive that I...
Yeah, in fact, I thought about that when I saw, I mean, this is a large book, and I'm sure in black and white it's expensive enough to create a book in black and white with this many photographs, but in color right. it would, people would have to mortgage their house to buy a copy.
Well, actually, to make the color, to make a photograph, a book that has color in it is pretty much the same cost, actually.
Oh, really?
Because the number of inks aren't that much different, and that actually is a duotone, so there's additional inks. And
I did notice that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think actually maybe color in some ways, because it's done so much more frequently, is maybe even less expensive in some ways. It's kind of odd, yeah.
And yours stands out because it is black and white, huh. including your cover.
Yeah. I think the other reason why I like black and white is that color is really great. But as you know, like colors have emotional overtones, like mm-hmm. red is kind of the color of passion or maybe danger, yellow, jaundice or cowardice, and these kinds of things kind of like are...
Almost a distraction.
Yes.
From what you want to say.
Exactly. And not that they're not important, but they do kind of, I have shot color, but it's, I just like to deal with, just simplify things a bit.
Well, there's one point in the book that Rebecca says, the greatest threat to a living river is ignorance. We can no more subdue water than we can stop the tides. We try anyway. and the river responds in highly visible ways. And if you look back at the history, say, of just the Sacramento River, you just wonder, how could people have done that? And you cut them some slack if you realize, well, they just didn't know. They didn't realize the consequences of what they were, the decisions they were making, perhaps.
Right. And one of the reasons I like the idea of doing a sort of a history, because I guess with gold mining, that's when we really, really kind of started to move water in ways that we hadn't done before. Of course, it had been done in Rome with the aqueducts and mm-hmm. things like that. So it's not a new process of diverting water. But in California, we really did start moving in big ways. And, you know, it's so you just see how things must have evolved. You can't really point your finger at anybody because back then I probably would have been digging for gold too. You know, it's that type of thing.
Yeah, that's what I mean, this ignorance. We can't really say there were bad people.
They weren't, no. But I think the same ethic is still with us where, you know, water really at that time was money because you needed the water to basically sluice the gold away from the dirt. And if you had a lot of water, you would be more likely to get more gold. And so it's always been one of those things where it's a commodity that's very, very...
Well, speaking of commodity, some people say that water is the new oil, that nations will fight over and die over water. But then Rebecca says, no, water is the old oil. And she refers to these ancient civilizations that grew up realizing how important water was. It was the most important thing. Mm-hmm. And so... when we talk about the decisions that were made in the past out of ignorance, do you think you're, I mean, this occurred to me that your book is maybe one way of dispelling this ignorance. Do you feel that way?
Yes, I do. Or at least, you know, I think it's easier to, you can see how we've inherited the values that, and I guess that's the thing that I was trying to do. In many ways, just trying to show what had happened.
Well, I didn't want to put words in your mouth,
exactly.
But why did you create this book?
Well, that's a good question. I think in a lot of ways it was just a critical mass of images that I had accumulated. A lot of the images did result from some of these grants where I was working for the Department of Water Resources where we were documenting or where I documented the restoration efforts where they would maybe take out a diversion dam and put in a siphon and put in fish ladders and engineering feats where hopefully there could be a win-win for the fish and the farmers. And so there were these challenges that I documented, and it was fun, and I enjoyed getting out there and doing it. And then I realized I had quite a body of work. My brother-in-law, Dennis Machida, passed now. He's been dead now for almost 8 years, I think. But he was the director of the Tahoe Conservancy, and we both really cared a lot about the environment. He always kind of said, you need to do something. He believed that art was a way of maybe connecting to the environment in a maybe more political way. Mm-hmm. And he actually introduced me to someone who helped to get the grant for the book.
My guest is Jeff Fricker, and his book is Sacrament, Homage to a River. And you were talking about some of the things that are subject of your photographs. Now, the cover is this wonderful photograph of the river itself. Describe for people who can't see it what that is.
It's kind of like a big S curve where mm-hmm. the water meanders, and that's an interesting thing. What it creates over a period of time when it does meander are these amazing riparian forests. So there's a history there, too, although it's a history that takes a period of time. But as it scours on one side, it creates a sandbar on the opposite side with seedlings of cottonwoods that come up every year. So every flushing flow that you get every year creates this riparian forest. And you still have the staircasing of cottonwoods on the side of the river where the water is slower. And so the more we channelize the river, the more we really sterilize it, because when you have the meandering aspect, it's just a rich environment that it creates. Not only that, it's a great way to control floods without having to have levees. And people like the River Partners, who sponsored the nonprofit for the book, They go out and basically create levee setbacks so the river can spread out more. And especially down where they did a really great project down where the Bear River and the Feather River, the confluence of those two, and then eventually it comes into the Sac, south of Marysville, a real big flood area that they basically moved the levees back to give the river more space to meander. And, of course, that helps to filtrate water into the ground, get more groundwater, but also it's a great way to control floods without having to build up levees.
Well, Rebecca says in the text part, water in a river travels in a helical path downstream, that water has to wander.
Yes. It's interesting. I guess if you take a pane of glass or just and put a droplet of water on the pane of glass and maybe have it at a 30 or 40 degree angle or something like that, or just any angle, you'll notice I didn't know this, but it's kind of cool. Water will not travel down the glass straight. It tends to meander down that piece of glass. So it's just something about the nature of water itself.
And we learn these things if we are close observers of nature.
Yeah, that's true.
In fact, you live on a creek yourself.
Yeah, no accident. I'm sure it's related to the fact that I grew up on the American.
And even now you live on the creek, Butte Creek.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, this term watershed comes up in your book, and explain to people what that is.
You know, that's a sort of hard for people to understand, but basically you have the shape of the land. Let's take the Sierras on, basically there's a top, the top part of the Sierras where it goes down to the east side, to Bishop, for example, and then you have the west side. Well, the shape of the land basically pretty much dictates where the water will go. A watershed also includes the groundwater under the stream as well. But
that's what people might not recognize. They recognize only what's the land surface they can see.
Yes, but basically, if we just take the west side and all the creeks and rivers around here, for example, Chico Creek, Butte Creek, Deer Creek, Mill Creek, Antelope Creek, all these creeks basically filter into the Sacramento, and they come from a higher level. So the ground and the geography and the shape of the land really dictates where the water goes, and that really is the watershed, but it's also the water that's underneath the ground as well.
So you, maybe you still do, but for 30 years you taught at Butte College.
I did.
So when you're
35, actually.
35.
Yeah.
When you're teaching your students, do you teach them about nature? I don't see how you could help but do that when you're teaching photography.
Yeah, I did get these grants, and I actually was able to teach a little bit less because I was able then to hire some people to fill in for some of my classes, and I really felt like it was important for me to stay somewhat current with my work. And
it's been a pleasure talking to you, Jeff.
Okay.
My guest has been Jeff Fricker. His book is Sacrament, Homage to a River. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, kcho.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.